First they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
Health and biotech news, a tech bro or sis would find kind of interesting.
We're here to celebrate the completion of the first survey.
On the advice of counsel, I will not be giving an opening statement.
Of the entire human genome.
Okay, so let's cover this new Andreessen Horowitz article saying that it's time to build in healthcare and why it's not as hard as you may think. And Imran, you're going to do why are all VCs so unhappy? So Imran, why are VCs so unhappy?
Yeah, so this is picking up on an article in Sifted that I read last week that says or claims based on a handful of interviews that there's a mental health crisis unfolding in the venture capital industry, particularly at the kind of junior and mid-levels, and that people are really struggling.
A lot of people won't have much sympathy for VCs. They're an incredibly privileged class of people. They seem to be very wealthy and not have to do any of the work that a founder has to do. And a lot of people will be saying, cry me an effing river. So why should we care?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that the comments on Twitter in response to people posting this article and sharing it have almost universally been negative. Like, you guys knew what you were getting into, everything you said about privilege, you're like not taking the risk of a founder. In terms of like why we should care, my view is that as a founder, having investors that have the capacity and the kind of resources, emotional, psychological, and time resources to support you as a founder is incredibly important. Because it's very, very lonely at the top of a company. Typically, I would say like there are two sources of support for founders. One, and this is outside like, you know, family and, you know, immediate friends and so on. One is other founders, so peer support, which is often informal, based on WhatsApp, sometimes in person, but has, you know, increasingly so, but not during the last kind of 3 years. And the second is with investors. And if you lose the support of your investors because your investors are struggling as well, I think it's really, really difficult. And it definitely has a trickle-down effect on the ability of founders to actually like tap into that support and will definitely make things harder.
So what is it in particular about a job as a venture investor that makes it so difficult?
So I think part of it is the inherent nature of investing work. If you think about being a venture investor, it's quite difficult to know when your job is done. Like, there isn't a clear definition of done of the work. Okay, sure, you've like deployed all the capital that you have to deploy, but, you know, no one stops there. They're raising the next fund. And if you just think about assessing and diligencing deals, closing deals, there's always another deal out there that you can source. There's always like more diligence you can do. You can keep looking, you keep turning over more rocks. I think the second thing is that VC funds really vary in size. Of course, there are the larger ones that have like a proper HR department and may have like benefits and support for their staff. But there are lots of small shops where culture is like not really well defined, is shaped by a small number of individual people, it's really variable. And if you're trying to get a job at a place like that, you can't easily make assumptions about the culture of the place based on what you've heard about the industry. It really depends on the people there. And finally, I think you just have such really motivated people that are like used to working hard and cranking because it's such like an elite profession in terms of the number of people that are trying to get in and the small number of roles. That you have people, I think, that maybe might be more prone to burnout. So I think these are all contributing factors. And, you know, when things go bad, especially like now in the market conditions where there have been real write-downs on the valuations of companies, lots of companies having to lay off staff, which is incredibly stressful for the founders, but also the investors by extension, also companies having to raise down round valuations, it just puts a lot of pressure on the entire ecosystem.
One thing I've noticed is I'm up at some weird hours. And if I ever email investors like, look, there's this cool new company, I know the founder, can I introduce you? I can email at like like midnight and I'll get a reply within 1 minute. To me, that gives me the impression that there is something about FOMO and time to act swiftly. Yeah. Like, you can be on a bank holiday weekend, but you kind of need to be available, right, if something comes up. And we saw
That's right.
With the SVB stuff as well, where this was all happening over a bank holiday weekend again. And you have to be, you can't just sign off, can you?
No, you can't say there's definitely like a bit of an always on culture. And I think it's a point of pride for investors as well. Like, you know, I'm the investor who's always available to my founders. Like, you can pick up the phone and call me 24/7. And that's part and parcel of like the kind of table stakes in the industry. But it definitely does contribute to this. So I would agree with that. And I think the SVP thing, yeah, aside from revealing the fact that there's relatively little sympathy for like the venture capital and founder class in society at large, I think it's the way it played out over the weekend. And even at the highest levels of government, actually, like a lot of the resolution came, I think, on a Sunday and was announced on a Monday morning, which is pretty wild. So yeah, definitely, that's a great point. And I've been speaking to my like friends in VC, and I've sent the article to a few of them to get their like off the record take. There seem to be two camps. So the first camp is that, yeah, like this is a huge problem and we need to fix it as an industry. Like someone is shining a light on this. And, you know, my fund has these like three commitments to protect the mental health of our people. Like, you know, we don't do communication on WhatsApp because WhatsApp is mixed up with your private life and you're always accessible. So we use like Teams or Slack or whatever. If they use Teams, I wouldn't take money from them. the second camp is like, you know, this is like slightly in, you know, if it bleeds, it leads journalism, and it's slightly overblown. The truth is that this comes down to individual discipline and time management, and the people that are burning out are just like bad at regulating themselves. And it's kind of overhyped, misplaced ambition, which is sort of leading them into a kind of downward spiral. And I think one of the challenges in a job like venture is the difference between being efficient and being effective. You could try and be efficient and like look at every single deal, diligence every single opportunity, scour every single market, every single database, but you need to figure out how to scope your time and be effective. And that's about finding the right opportunities and, you know, not kind of burning yourself out in the process and just kind of figuring out how you're going to go about that in your own fund, in your own role.
I don't know about that point. I can just say generally as a young person with ambitions, I mean, you can draw parallels from the world of medicine and surgery as well, but when you're junior in your career and you were talking about early and mid-level people suffering from this the most, you don't necessarily know how to work effectively. Like you don't know what that means. So in some ways you've got to just put the graft in, put the hours in, and then, you know, that's part of your journey is realizing what's effective and what's not. So it's very difficult early on to know, like, you know, this is going to be effective output versus this is just me putting loads of hours in for no real benefit.
That's fair. And I think that's where the apprenticeship model really comes into it. Like VC, like medicine in a sense is an apprenticeship profession where you're learning from your like near peers that are a few years ahead or the partners or what have you. And I think that that pattern recognition and, you know, your modus operandi that sort of emerges from that is critically important. Otherwise, like I've seen it in consulting as well. There were some people that had a reputation for literally boiling the ocean on every study, for burning through their teams. Sometimes it wasn't individual people. It was like a practice, a sector, an office that had a terrible reputation. And I think the jury's still out as to whether that actually leads to better results or not. I haven't seen any kind of compelling evidence that it does.
And another point around this is I think some people, or maybe this is just myself 6 months ago, think of capital allocators or VCs as people who don't have a boss. Like you have the founder who's going to them for money and then the person giving the money is the boss. But VCs also have bosses. They have LPs as well. And when you have this expectation and when you've taken money off people, that creates its own stress as well, right?
It does. And I think that LPs will see the value of the portfolios of the funds that they've invested in going down, and that will make them pay more attention, potentially be more demanding, cut less slack to the investors. The other aspect of this is that, you know, a lot of funds have like mandatory commitments from the partners themselves. So let's say it's 1% or 2% of the funds that are being committed by the partners. The article cites examples of people having to basically take loans and invest those loans into their own funds so that they co-invest alongside their LPs. And then just that kind of financial pressure that places on them. So I don't know how common that is. I don't think it's a kind of uniform practice. But yeah, these are just some of the things, as you say, like you could have, you know, VCs have bosses at the end of the day.
I don't know if this is my toxic productivity take on all of these things, but is not the lesson from this that if you want to make a lot of money and have a high status, high prestige job that gives you a lot of autonomy, you're going to, like, everything's not roses. Like you're going to have to work really hard, and that should just be expected. There's no free dinner sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's the case. I think, you know, working smart is part of it, but there's no way to get away from the fact that a lot of the people who have achieved the type of status or the type of seniority or roles that you're looking at have actually put the graft in for many, many years. Certainly the case with a lot of founders. It's not as glamorous as it looks from the outside.
Do you have a lot of sort of rich, successful friends. Do you know of any industries or examples of people who you don't think have had to work very hard, apart from people who've just been given money?
No, but I think that there are examples of people who have ridden like the hype cycle or have ridden the wave very effectively. So I'm not going to like name any names, but there have been like public comments or articles written or tweets about folks who have basically, you know, like at certain points in the last few years, we've had sort of astronomical bubbles where valuations have soared and companies have seen that there's so much capital available that they'll raise a round. And then within a year, even though they've got still have a lot of the capital in reserve, they'll raise another round and like 2x, 3x, 4x the valuation. And in some cases, you know, cash out themselves as founders through what's called a secondary sale, which is where they'll sell a big chunk of their own equity in a fundraising round to investors. And the company, you know, basically deflating dramatically as this hype cycle has kind of unwound and as these waves have sort of crashed onto the shores. But, you know, by that point, the founders kind of taken 100 million, 200 million off the table. These are kind of ridiculous numbers that many founders will never exit in their entire lives. But there was a period recently where that was happening, you know, even during the course of the early stages of company creation, when the company is definitely not out of the woods, nowhere near profitability in most cases.
Okay, so we've said a lot. So what's the conclusion or closing remarks on that story? Should they have our sympathy?
I'll leave that to the listeners to decide. Maybe they could leave a comment under the YouTube video. I would say that for anyone who's thinking about a career in VC, it's really important to get to know the people that you'll be working with and to understand the working culture in that fund. You can't make assumptions about the industry and apply them to a specific team or to a specific office. You need to get under the skin. On the other hand, if you're saying, I want to go work in the NHS or I want to go work in a consulting company or a bank, you know, people can actually make some generalizations about the experience that you'll have if you go there. I don't think you can do that with these smaller shops. Like, as I said, you really need to drill down and understand who the people are, how they work, how they make decisions, what the expectations are, and try and get that, you know, off the record conversation before you take a job or before you commit to something.
Okay, so let's cover this Andreessen Horowitz article that was published very recently called It's Time to Build in Healthcare. A while ago, Mark Andreessen released an article called Founders, It's Time to Build. That's a very famous sort of motivational piece that was released during the time of COVID. But this new article asks for...
I'm surprised they didn't get cancelled for hustle culture.
Yeah, absolutely. But this new article calls for people in tech to start building in healthcare. And it starts off by going through all the challenges of building in healthcare. So before I go through the article, Imran, as someone who built a successful healthcare company, what did you find were maybe two or three of the big challenges of entering the healthcare space, especially as someone who doesn't have a medical background? You're just someone in tech or you're a finance type person. What are the big challenges?
Yeah, that's great. It's a really good question. And I think, you know, would love to see more people from even outside healthcare founding in healthcare. In fact, there's a really good article, if anyone's looking, by the founders of Flatiron, which was acquired by Roche for almost $2 billion, on why not being an insider in an industry, and they were not insiders in healthcare, why that can be an advantage and how they went about it. So in my
experience... Was that Zach Weinberg?
Yeah, Zach. Yeah, it's really good. It's a really good piece. Maybe we can post it in the notes below.
Yeah.
I do believe healthcare is materially harder. In my understanding, it takes longer to build a successful healthcare company and achieve an exit than it does in many, many other industries. And the nature of healthcare itself is just so sensitive because you're often dealing either with very privileged information or you're dealing with people whose health is fragile or who are, you know, have specific needs, for example, even when it comes to like accessing digital services. So the company that we built, even though it was a relatively simple software product, we were serving the kind of cross-section of people that use healthcare. Just as an example, that cross-section of people is like older, sicker, and more disadvantaged than an average cross-section of society. So you have, and if you think about companies working in elderly care as an example, again, you'll have like a very different set of user needs. So building for that population, building for everyone as many healthcare services will have to do is just an incredibly difficult thing to do. And you have to be super careful when it comes to the safety of your data, the safety of your service, where you're directing patients, how you're sharing information with them, how you're counseling them, et cetera, because you can actually cause a lot of harm with your patients who often can be very vulnerable as they're accessing your services. So it's really hard to do. The kind of move fast and break things adage just doesn't work very well in health.
Yeah, and some of the other challenges they talk about is that, of course, it's a highly regulated industry, which causes problems. There's lots of embedded legacy players. It's also super complicated. I'm definitely guilty of talking about, say, US healthcare or the NHS as a big monolith, when in fact, it can be hundreds of thousands of individual health systems building that up that are all very, very different, operating different systems, etc. So some examples that come to mind are Microsoft launched their own health record system in 2007 called Health Vault that failed. We've just seen Pear Therapeutics go bankrupt after receiving $400 million in funding. Google Health, I don't fully actually understand this, but it seems like they launched in 2008, then shut down in 2012. Now they're kind of back in business, but kind of not really. So it looks like even the big players really struggle coming into this space.
Yeah, that's right. And exactly for the reasons you said, like, it's a super, super complex environment. It's not like a uniform landscape. I myself am guilty of the same thing of referring to it as, like, the, as you said, the NHS or US healthcare. You also have this like misalignment of incentives. You know, we, for example, had a business that was integrating into a really dominant EHR system in the UK. And we had a really difficult time getting this like behemoth to play with our software to like get through the integration process and get it signed off. Like, it took maybe 2 to 3 times as long as it should have. And a lot of that just comes down to incentives. It comes down to, like, you know, why should the entrenched players or the interests accommodate somebody who's going to, you know, get in their way, who's going to disintermediate them with their patients, who's going to chip away at parts of their product. And so you have all of these walled gardens that you have to navigate as a startup. It's incredibly challenging. The other big difficulty is around commercialization. In many healthcare systems, the user, the end user of your product, is not the same person as the customer. You know, somebody else, a different organization, might be paying for care for a patient, just as an example. And that, again, creates a kind of dislocation in your go-to-market and your commercialization models, because you're catering to the needs of like many different stakeholders all at the same time, you know, to generate the evidence to show that the product is good, but then to get the product sold, you know, using your commercial motion in a different stakeholder group. So that can be really complicated. It's like a difficult path to walk. Lots of good products don't actually reach commercial success as a result.
And let's give the bull case then, because there has to be a reason that Oracle just acquired Cerner for $28 billion. Microsoft acquired Nuance for $19 billion. So why are they doing that? And this article outlines a number of reasons. One of the big ones is just the amount of spend in healthcare. So the US is spending 18% of their GDP, which is over $4 trillion in healthcare. And that's projected to go up. A really interesting fact, actually, I was speaking to Ben Maratapu, who heads up Sierra Care, which is a huge company that's, I think, approaching unicorn status.
Yeah.
He was telling me that a lot of the sexy startups, so let's just take food delivery, so Uber Eats, Deliveroo, et cetera, they are big in the press and such, but just the social care market in the UK is bigger than the whole European food delivery market. And we've got multiple unicorns in the food delivery space. So there's so much opportunity. So it's kind of this thing about, if you want to catch a fish, go to where the fish are. It's a sector where you've got unconstrained demand. People will always want to spend on their health. Once we tackle one thing, then, you know, you've got the next thing, and it's a bit of a whack-a-mole game. And also just that, especially in the US, but elsewhere as well, 15 to 30% of spend is on administrative costs. So there's a lot of bloat that we can work on challenging.
I think the other thing is that when you're thinking about the value that can be created from healthcare, health tech, biotech, and anything in that sector, really what you're doing is you're delivering, ultimately you should be delivering on an improvement in like health span or lifespan. And there will always be someone who will basically pay that incremental dollar for an improvement in health span or lifespan. You could say even that there's almost infinite upside, because the value of extending a human life is like greater than the value of you know, anything else that we as a society and industry can sort of create. So the prize will always be enormous. And I think that also explains why, particularly in sectors like longevity and in these really outside bets at the frontiers of biotechnology and curing the uncurable and so on, there is such a premium, and there's so much capital that's willing to be deployed on these really high risk bets, because you know, just the value of like being able to save somebody's life or to cure something is just so enormous. And as a physician, you know, I believe that. Like, I think that there's like, there are few things that kind of come close to that in terms of how important they should be to the kind of progress of humankind, as like, you know, taking the burden of a disease and the suffering away from another human being, or giving them another shot at life when they're at death's door.
Well, this is another point they touch on, that the newer generation are more inclined to do stuff that matters. If they're going to be spending 40 to 80 hours a week working on something, maybe they don't want to be inventing the next platform that's going to hook all kids and, you know, make them all depressed, or be in gamble tech. You know, they want to do something meaningful that matters. And health is sort of, well, I would say the top example of that, one of the most sort of noble things to work towards, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you. Like, the younger generations, Gen Z, is increasingly socially conscious. I've also seen some data recently that female investors are increasingly and have a higher preponderance of investing in socially impactful causes, which is, I think, really interesting for anyone who's trying to champion the case for more women in entrepreneurship and in investing. So I totally agree.
They also tackle some of this imposter syndrome that people who are in tech might have when entering healthcare, because the first thing you might think is,
who in tech has the imposter syndrome? I haven't met this person.
Yeah. You might think, I don't have an MD, I don't have a PhD, how can I go into this? And they make a really interesting point, which is that healthcare at its core is a data operations and logistics problem, and then a consumer experience and engagement problem. And just to explain what that means, especially in the US, we've spoken about their problems with their current life and health span and how it should be much higher given they're the most advanced health system in the world. Just as an example, we essentially have treatments, or we have preventative measures towards many of the big ailments that we suffer from, but it's actually kind of an access problem, or it's a behavioral problem, or it's something else. It's not that we don't have the technology or we don't have the discovery there. It's about implementing that and getting people on board. And those are going to be the problems coming forward in healthcare. An example they give is that even if we cured cancer, we would only extend lifespan by 3 years. So there's like, it's not just about innovation in the sense that a PhD could do in a lab. It's all these other problems about access and consumer experience and engagement, etc. What do you think of that?
Yeah, and I think that point is even further reinforced by, you know, if you look at like what does comprise most preventative medicine today, the truth is that like most preventative medicine that will give people, you know, a longer health span and a longer life expectancy is not really at the sharp end of some gene therapy. I know there are companies that are trying to basically, you know, treat cholesterol with gene therapies that target the liver, for example. Like, if you just put those aside for a second, it's a lot of it's about like getting, closing the kind of knowledge and implementation gap, which is like everything that we know about cardiovascular disease prevention, everything we know about cancer prevention, and implementing that, you know, as effectively as possible within the population to give people the best shot at controlling their blood pressure early, controlling their blood sugar early, getting the right amount of physical activity and exercise, helping them to manage their stress levels, and so on and so forth. And a lot of that is not just about healthcare, you know, it's also about the built environment and the economy and all of those other things that kind of influence people's health. So I buy that argument. I think that there will be conditions at the frontier where, you know, people who have largely lived a relatively, you know, like relatively reasonable length life, and then they're losing the last 5%, losing the last 10%, and then we'll keep pushing the frontier out. But there's so much low-hanging fruit at the lower end, at the earlier end, using like old technologies, old medications that have been discovered over the last 30 years, and just optimizing treatment.
So final question is, after building your first healthcare startup, I don't think you have any imminent plans to build another one. So why have you made that decision not to go back as someone who's got the battle scars from your first one?
Yeah. I am thinking about it, but it's partly like, you know, at this stage in life, we have more kids than when we started, in fact, double the number. Just like responsibilities, you know, some of that does get a little bit in the way of taking the kind of risk and plunging back into that, you know, straight away. So I see that I have, personally, like I have other ways that I can support the ecosystem, other founders, and work with other investors and so on. And for now, that's kind of keeping me interested and off the streets.
That was a very politician's answer that conveyed no information. But yeah, no, so maybe not.
Maybe not. I think definitely in the future, at some point in my career, I would like to start another company, like another health, you know, like a high potential tech startup, for want of a better way of describing it. But at this moment in time, yeah, not just now.
Okay, fine. Shall we finish off on some feedback?
Sure.
So we've got a couple of bits of feedback. Nothing too negative, unfortunately. So we got someone commented, "Keep up the great work, guys. I really enjoy your videos. Thanks." Someone else, this was the negative one. They put, "Love how young people pretend to know about longevity as if they've experienced it. You should ask my great-grandmother to write a book because she lived to 104. So sort of a valid point.
Yeah, it's a valid point. I wouldn't argue with that.
Yeah. And then we got like a kind of private message just saying, "I just want to say I've really been enjoying your podcast and try spreading the word amongst my team here. Thanks for what you're doing and keep it up." So I think we've been getting, I think people have been enjoying this. We've got some positive feedback.
Awesome. So where's Adam this week?
I don't actually know. He messaged what, like 2 hours before saying something had come up. So, yeah. I think Adam's been on TV a little bit.
Okay. Adam, if you're watching this, that's the second last minute cancellation. Strike two.
Yeah, he's been traveling, I think, in the Arab world. He's been on some, I think he's filming a documentary series type thing. The problem is all of this is in Arabic language, so I don't actually ever know what's going on. I just see the pictures. But he's doing some cool stuff. I guess the other thing is that we've not been super consistent. We've been away for a few weeks. That was Ramzan, all of that stuff, and differing schedules.
Yeah, it's a problem with not having a very diverse cast on the pod is that when it's Eid, everybody goes off.
Exactly, but we'll be good for Christmas at least.
Yeah, we'll be releasing an edition on the 25th of December. Okay. Special edition.
Awesome. Okay, so we'll do this again soon. Thanks, Imran.
Cheers, dude.